Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we'll be talking with Dr. Andrea Lee Press, professor of sociology and media studies at UVA, about media and gender in the cultural consciousness. Welcome, Dr. Press.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate your coming down here today. My lovely producer, Olivia August, helped me set this show up. And so I met you about 5 minutes ago. I've checked you out on the internet. Tell me a little bit about your background and about how you ended up in sociology and media studies.
Well, I have always been a great fan of the media and grew up in a rather media-saturated household, which was a little more unusual when I was growing up than right now.
Your parents watched a lot of TV?
That's exactly it. But also, I lived right outside New York City, and so we attended a serious number of films and shows and all kinds of plays. And
so you just got really steeped in film.
I did, yes. And so right now I teach a lot about American film heritage. I teach a class called The Sociology of American Film. And,
and I know you're a Hitchcock buff.
I teach a class in Hitchcock and Sirk, my two favorite directors. And so I enjoy media, but as a feminist sociologist, I've also developed a critical feminist perspective on media, in particular.
I would think it would be heavy on the critical in Hitchcock.
It's pretty heavy.
I would think
so. It's pretty heavy. It's hard to be simultaneously a fan and a critic, but that is the position I occupy.
I understand. So it sounds like you've got some film history under your belt, both from kind of your personal experience as a child watching films on through today, and also from your studies.
Well, I've also been very fortunate to have been one of the producers of the Roger Ebert Festival of Overlooked Films when I was on the faculty at University of Illinois.
I did not know there was a Roger Ebert Festival of Overlooked Films.
Annual.
What makes it into the Festival of Overlooked Films?
Well, Roger used to pick all the films personally, and he would pick films he thought had not received the kind of critical attention they deserved. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting panoply of films.
I see.
And his wife, Chaz Ebert, is continuing the selection with a board at University of Illinois. When I came to University of Virginia, I was privileged to serve as executive director of the Virginia Film Festival for the first several years I was here, in addition to creating the Media Studies Department, which houses the Film Studies concentration right now.
What were the themes of the film festivals the year you were the executive director?
One year we had family, one year we had aliens. It was back when we had themes. We had a very imaginative program.
Yes, aliens.
Aliens.
What did you show in the Aliens Film Festival?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we had a special event where we rebroadcast Orson Welles' War of the Worlds radio broadcast.
Nice.
So our radio heritage in the astronomy observation deck at night. So it was very exciting to have that event and other films you might predict.
Of course, like Sigourney Weaver, for example. And I so want to get to Sigourney because she's one of my favorites. But
Sigourney.
I love Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah, she's been an innovator.
But I want to start off talking about Star Wars. When Olivia kind of pitched this show to me, she says, we need to talk about Rey and Star Wars. And I was like, social justice? Law? And then I was like, oh, okay, maybe social justice. So in preparation for this, I've read a few critical articles, you know, and it seems like there's this kind of schism, right? There's this, you know, Rey is the feminist savior star of the world, and she's this great thing. And then there's kind of, and Tell me what your perspective is on Rey and the whole Star Wars dilemma.
Rey is certainly a step forward in my perspective as a feminist.
From what?
From, I remember going to see the original Star Wars film in 1978 with Carrie Fisher. She's a more active figure than Princess Leia was back then. She is more central to the plot, to the quest, to the narrative of the story. She's not dressed in as revealing and sexualized attire as Carrie Fisher was.
One of my friends put it to me this week as, you know, that Star Wars, the original Princess Leia was Carrie Fisher in a swimsuit chained to a giant slug. And I was like, oh, yeah.
With very odd hair.
Very odd. Yeah, she did have weird hair. That's
very odd.
That's true. But the whole slug thing. But then I was, you know, I was thinking about it and thinking, yeah, but she choked the slug to death with a chain, right? And I mean,
she was kind of cool.
She shot people up and, you know, planned the destruction of the Death Star.
I want to destroy Carrie Fisher's character.
I think Carrie Fisher was kind of a tough one. Yes, I get it. The whole bathing suit thing was, you know, really screwy, but.
And
the bathing suit thing,
it's interesting you bring that up. That's a continuing problem, I think, when you apply a critical perspective to women in Hollywood film. They tend to be dressed in very clingy, sexualized, revealing attire. As a result, the women who populate popular Hollywood films tend to be younger than the men on average, several decades younger. In fact, they tend to be unrepresentative in their body types. They tend to
have
tiny, tiny waists.
Right.
We have studies of waist size in the depiction of Hollywood.
You mean
women.
Out there somewhere, there's someone doing a study of the waist of women?
There are. Dr. Stacy Smith.
You have like charts in front of you. Are you kidding?
School at USC.
Okay.
Often funded by the Gina Davis Institute for Gender and Media. Studies waist size.
What is the average waist size of a woman in a feature film?
You know, I can't really answer that. Of course, that's a really difficult thing to measure. I'm sure what Stacy Smith is doing is having a dozen researchers decide that waist size looks hyper small, and so they mark X small, XX small in their perception of what the character's waist size looks like. Because everyone's blown up to 40 times their normal
size. Of course.
On the film screen. And she's finding that women's waist sizes are represented as extra, extra small, as well as their body types.
I wonder if what she's finding is that the women who are in the film, their waist sizes are extra, extra small, or if what she's finding is that the perceptions of the women who are watching the films is that their waist sizes are extra, extra small.
Yeah, you can't, of course, measure that.
Well, it's subjective, unless you put a tape measure on somebody.
All of it is subjective, but then again, as a sociologist, it's not entirely individual. We can do studies that show that on average 90% of people would watch the 10 top grossing films and evaluate the women's body types in the central roles as unusually thin with unusually small waists.
Gotcha.
And that's not accidental.
Is that true across gender? Do men evaluate those women as having really small waist sizes too?
That's a very specific question that I cannot answer.
We don't know.
Actually,
I wonder.
I do think there's probably a disparity in the way women watch women's bodies and the way men watch them. I see what you're getting at. Probably the more important issue is how women watch them, because that's where the harmful impact is coming. Young girls watching seemingly adult women, although they tend to be very young adults in leading roles in Hollywood film, and absorbing this is how society thinks we should look.
Therefore, and I should become anorexic and
exactly.
I should hate my body. And
well, unfortunately, we have high incidences of body dissatisfaction amongst very young women.
Yes.
And we feel that media contributes to that.
I'm sure media contributes to it. All right, but let's talk a little more about Ray. So Ray's a tough girl.
Ray is tough.
And yeah. Ray is out there shooting things. I like this scene mm-hmm. in the movie where Han Solo mm-hmm. offers her a gun, and she says, "I can take care of myself." And he says, "I know, that's why I'm giving it to you." That struck me as kind of an unusual film moment.
Which might open up a whole other discussion that we probably want to avoid here.
Why do we want to avoid
gun rights and who gets to own
guns? Oh, I don't think we should avoid that discussion. Let's talk about it. Absolutely. Let's talk about guns in media. I mean, Leah's out there. The part of why we think Leah's, you know, tough is because she's shooting the stormtroopers, right? I mean, that's why I think she's tough. Resisted torture.
You brought up Hitchcock earlier. And Hitchcock made a film in 1966 called Torn Curtain. It's not generally regarded as one of his better efforts, but there's a scene that's highly lauded in that film. It's he set out to show how difficult it is to actually kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So he has this very extended murder sequence mm-hmm. where three people in a room are trying to murder somebody silently so that the KGB agent outside doesn't hear them.
And they just won't die.
He gets hit over the head. He gets stuck into the oven. He gets stabbed. It's just really difficult to get this guy to die.
Right.
And I think what Hitchcock was getting at is we see so much violence in ordinary Hollywood film, and it's so facile. In a way,
right.
Murder is so easy. Murder,
bang.
Yeah, and it's not very messy, and
mm-hmm,
it's not
mm-hmm.
difficult. And he wanted to portray something that went against that grain. And I think, unfortunately, we still haven't really challenged the grain of excessive violence, easy killing.
I think violence in reality is getting easier and more excessive. I mean, we have drones now, right? Some kid sitting in Nebraska in a bunker somewhere is killing people in another country, like playing a video game. I mean, that's kind of the reality that has come
for
about.
For him, yes, and that might be having an impact on the way people perceive murder in an everyday setting.
Maybe.
I mean, I do think this is a huge social problem, and it's a gendered problem, and our media don't treat it as such.
Well, talk to me about that. I saw on your Facebook page, I Facebook stalked you before my show, that you had a one of the posts that was up at the top of your page when I first looked at it, maybe a week ago, was a chart. And it was just a little blurb, like you got, I didn't read the whole article, but it was about gun violence and how it falls out along gender lines, right?
It's
and
this pretty sort of frightening.
Men shoot people, women don't shoot people.
In a world of women, we would have very little gun violence.
Yeah, we'd have more strangling. I don't know. More poisoning.
Maybe, but less murder overall, I think.
Do you think so?
I am absolutely convinced of it, yes.
Why?
I think men are way more violent than women in our society as it stands now. They are responsible for, the numbers would stagger you. Something like 97% of all murders are committed by men.
Right.
Do the media portray violence as a gendered problem? Not really. And I think part
of that... Don't you think that 97% of all the shootings in film are perpetrated by men, too? And that's part of the criticism you're making, is that the women aren't tough?
Well, I think the women are tough. I don't think people who shoot people are necessarily the tough people.
All right, but if we're going to say, you know, Princess Leia's wussy, she's chained to this giant worm, right? You know, and Rey's better because she's got a blaster and she's out there being an action figure.
But she's not an action figure on the model of male action figures.
Tell me about
that.
She's
different.
It's an interesting thing to say. Tell me why.
I think inherently she projects a more complex narrative. She's and Rey is not necessarily a very emotional figure. But I think watching that film, you get the sense of more emotional complexity to the story, more focus on the family issues, more focus on the impact of what's going on in the world, in the universe, on the individuals involved.
We're kind of talking about the backstory to Rey and early in the film when they're showing, you know, her life, right? She's out there scavenging metal and parts of things. And
very intense emotional scenes with her family. And
She's having flashbacks to having been abandoned.
Exactly.
Was she abandoned or was she...
You know, I'm unfortunately
not
the expert on the Star Wars
story. It's not clear what happens to Rey.
Listening to many accounts from students, my own children, my husband, all of whom are diehard Star Wars fans. I've never developed that.
No, but I mean, you watched the movie. I only watched the movie once, too. I mean, we took a... My wife and son and I went to see it, you know, within a very short time of it coming out. And I have to say, I was very pleased that, you know, my 10-year-old son was, like, interested in Star Wars. That, you know, it wasn't just like, are you watching, Mom? Why do you, you know? I was a little worried that it was going to be like...
Well, it clearly offers very imaginative stories for those who are attracted to that genre.
Yeah, although I have to say it was kind of, I found it a little disappointing. The storyline in some ways seemed like a replay of the first storyline to me, and I was kind of like, come on, come up with something new.
They don't seem to be able to. I would advise more emphasis on the writers. Hiring great writers. I personally know at least a dozen unemployed writers who could add some great detail to
that. Of course,
that
then
story.
Again, you have to say, well, what's the measure of success? Is the measure of success that it was a great story or that it grossed X bazillion dollars at the box office?
Well, and that's one of the issues with our Hollywood industry.
It's probably the X bazillion dollars.
They're looking at the dollar signs and they're pleased with this film.
I gotcha. So let's move on to Sigourney Weaver, one of my favorite topics.
Oh my goodness.
For a moment.
An Alien fan.
I loved that movie. I loved all those movies. But what I'm thinking of first, you know, my first recollection of seeing Sigourney Weaver was in Ghostbusters, right? And you talk about this sort of, you know, chained to a giant slug routine. I mean, Sigourney Weaver was this over-sexualized gatekeeper who was waiting for the keymaster. I mean, and she was this kind of almost not sentient thing, right? You know, and I remember it was way over the top, and it was funny because, you know,
it was
self-consciously way over the top, right? You know, and so it was kind of okay, but it was also kind of awful.
But I think Sigourney Weaver, she's a really interesting actress because in some ways she projects a rather androgynous image, certainly. And in the Alien films, there was enormous attention to them in the feminist media community when they first came out.
I saw somewhere, I was looking at this a little bit too, that I saw a storyline, I don't know if this is true or not, but that when they made the first Alien movie, they didn't expect everybody to be as crazy about the Sigourney Weaver character as they were. What do you think happened there?
Well, she was entirely new. And that's a really good example of the point I'm trying to make. I mean, not only was she the tough guy, the one in charge, the one out in front of the battle, but she was a nurturant, mothering figure. And really, we had never seen this in an action film.
That's true. There was a very kind of mama bear feeling to her.
Very much. And didn't she have a child in one of those
films? In one of the movies, she had, there was a little girl that she was
I know she had a cat in one of them.
I remember the cat, too.
Yeah. She was really mothering.
My recollection is that and I could be totally off base about this, but I think it was the first... Was it the first film where there was a little girl?
Yeah, I think so.
And then, you know, and she was, you know...
And it ended with her taking the little girl home.
Right, she saved her, But then in the second film starts out, I think, with her. Is it her who's doing the doing the pull-ups and with a shaved head and the whole,
I don't remember the other characters.
I don't know, but she's
I'm imagining Clint Eastwood somehow, but
yeah, it was that kind of thing, though. I mean, it was. She was much more androgynous in that next film. Uh-huh. She was almost. Uh-huh. She was pretty butch. Actually.
I remember that.
You know, it was like, you know, yeah. I had my, you know, I've been through this hell, and now, you know.
Come and get me.
I'm tough, right? You know.
I dare you.
And so she went from, you know, the gatekeeper, mm-hmm. you know, please come, Keymaster, to, you know, I'm going to stick a shotgun in this monster's mouth. And
so, you know, when you put women in these leading roles in action films, you tend to just simply have a more complex figure there. Mothering, androgynous. It's not the sort of straight-ahead, uber-masculine figure that you often get with the buff men wielding weapons, guns, knives.
Sure, but I wonder if, like, you know, if being sort of over-sexualized in terms of, you know, you have a lovely body and we're going to put you in a bikini and chain you to a slug... is, you know, in some ways, if the, okay, now you're going to be mama, is another iteration of that in a way, right? I mean, you get to be tough mama, but you have to be mama.
She managed not to wear a bikini, though. She was pretty, as I remember the costuming in Alien and Aliens, I don't remember it that well. She was pretty low-key.
Oh, no, she was tough. I mean, she was very tough. Yeah. I'm just saying, I think that it's interesting that, you know, once we get away from the bikini construct, we have to go straight into this other mothering thing, right?
It's like stereotype.
Women, you know, okay, well, if you can't be the sex object, then you must be the mama.
Or hyper-emotional.
Right. Sure. I don't know.
Yeah.
I later on, Sigourney Weaver went on and she did Gorillas in the Mist, right? Mm-hmm. She was this kind of scientist.
Diane Fossey, who's an incredible... role model, really, for
but
women.
She went from from, you know, possessed sex demon to you know, Rambo, right, with a mama bear streak to scientist, and then in Avatar she did this kind of scientist thing, but she was also you know, in both of those scientist roles she was also kind of the mother, right? She was the mother of the gorillas. Mm-hmm. She was the mother of, you know, she was trying to protect and nurture this tribe on this planet. And the
well, you know, I think one of the issues for those who write the stories for these leading films is that women portrayed straight ahead action gun wielding types are often not received very sympathetically. Yeah, I'm trying to think about... I'm thinking of Zero Dark Thirty, the Catherine Bigelow film.
It's way back there somewhere.
You know, we have, of course, we have a lot, and Sigourney Weaver played one of them. We have a lot of evil, powerful women bosses. She played this in 1984 in Working Girl with Melanie Griffith as the good girl working her way up and Sigourney Weaver as her boss trying to steal her idea and keep her down.
Okay, all right.
You forgot that
one. No, I don't think I ever saw that one.
She's fabulous in it, but not sympathetic. We have Meryl Streep more recently playing the evil boss in Devil Wears Prada.
And what was that
Annie Hathaway
show, Damages? Do you remember the cable show, or who was
Damages.
That? Was that Meryl Streep? Or?
I can't remember.
Yeah, you know. Glenn Close, maybe?
Glenn Close.
Glenn Close,
yeah,
wasn't
Glenn
it?
Close.
It was Glenn Close. Yeah, she was...
It's difficult for extremely powerful women to be received sympathetically without some softening feature. And that's something we find in research on the business world.
Yeah,
RL, real life. In real life, we find that, okay, Sheryl Sandberg tells us to lean in and own our power. But often women find when they do that, they're evaluated negatively.
Oh, it's the Madonna whore dilemma, right? I mean,
it's
you know.
Really a problem for women trying to make it in competitive industries, and we're a little bit at sea right now.
What's
when
a problem
we try
in,
to advise young women
it's a problem
what
in
strategies
law.
Work. In law, it's a huge problem.
It's a, you know, sure. it's got its issues. You end up walking a line. I tend to stomp all over the line, but, you know, I've gotten away with it for... reasons that I'm not clear on.
You have to be lucky.
But
you really have to be lucky. I mean, it's really a problem. And you can't just advise women to be tough and act like men.
Did you watch the Commonwealth Attorney's race in Albemarle this year?
I didn't.
There was a race between Denise Lunsford, who was the incumbent Commonwealth, and Robert Tracy, who was the challenger. He was a Republican. She was a Democrat.
Uh-huh.
And one of the huge criticisms that I think hurt Denise in the race was that people didn't like the way she dressed. They did not like the way she dressed.
I believe it. Look, Terry Sullivan, president of University of Virginia, in one of her annual evaluations by the board, they mentioned the way she dressed, her clothing.
Really? What'd they say?
I wrote this up in an article, in two articles.
Is this at the time when they were trying to oust her? Because they...
Well, one of the things they mentioned in that attempted ouster were poor annual evaluations, and when you actually examined the content of those evaluations, they included issues like her clothing.
They didn't like her lipstick, or what?
Now, well, Terry's response to that in the media was, I wasn't quite sure what they objected to. I mean, they weren't specific. They just talked about her quote-unquote unprofessional clothing. Why are we evaluating powerful, successful, competent women, beloved by their faculty, which President Sullivan is and was, according to someone's subjective perception of how they dress?
This just seems a little funny, though. I mean, men have a dress code to go to, right? You wear a suit. Right, there is a suit.
You do.
One suit.
Exactly.
The real questions are what color will the shirt and tie be? Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, it's a suit.
Mm-hmm.
And women have this whole sort of range of other options to them, which leaves them open to that kind of problem.
And that's not written in stone. Why is it that men have the functional, comfortable, non-revealing suit that they wear every day?
Mm-hmm.
And my own pet peeve, sensible, supportive shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely, wonderful shoes. If we wore men's shoes, I think we'd be ruling the world.
Well, let's wear them. You got some kind of styling black boots on there, and they actually look pretty comfy.
They're comfy. They're flat-heeled. I used to chew women's shoes. But, you know, this is not... if you look at the history of clothing, the men's suit is an enormous step forward for men feeling comfortable and empowered.
We
have not achieved that step yet.
I remember having this conversation once. I was at the Virginia Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers annual conference, I came down to breakfast, and I was talking to an attorney, another defense attorney I know, a guy named David Baugh, who's a hilarious man. This was years ago. And he says to me, I am very butch. I'm a lesbian. I wear men's suits to courts. I wear cowboy boots. Screw everybody who doesn't like it. That's what I do. And he says to me, you know, why are you dressed like that? Right?
It wasn't a mean question.
Right. It wasn't, he didn't mean it that he meant really, you know, tell me about that. Right. And I said, well, David, you know, do you think you would feel as personally powerful? Would you hear your theme music playing when you walked into the courtroom in a prom dress? You know? And he's like,
I can't really answer that.
Right. You know? And I'm like, well, you know, this is how it is. And, you know, it was a really kind of a neat conversation to have at the time. And I'm kind of watching it. Last time I saw David, by the way, at this year's VACDL conference, he had he's a big black man with a beard, and he had the shirt on that said, "This is what a feminist looks like."
For David.
I love David. He's a hoot. But anyway, now I think he got it ultimately. He's like, yeah, okay, all right.
But, you know, it's astonishing how, if you really look at it, it's somewhat obvious, but our culture doesn't recognize this disparity. And it spills over into evaluations of professionals.
Although I think there are men who wish that they had more choice in their dress.
I haven't met them. They're
They're called trans people.
Yeah.
Some of them anyway.
There you go.
But there probably are some men who wish they had more choice. It's time for us to...
I was thinking of my husband who always thinks he has way too many choices in the morning.
Well,
which
maybe.
Sweater do I wear? Which suit
maybe.
Do I wear?
Okay, I think it's time for us to take a break.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
Okay, so moving on now in this conversation, okay. I'm talking to Andrea Press, and we're talking about gender and media and how those things intersect in the cultural consciousness. I want to ask you now to turn your attention to social media, right? We've been talking about film. We've been talking about a little bit of radio with Orson Welles. You know, big public media. Let's talk a little about social media. How do you think social media is changing that conversation?
Oh, how interesting. Well, there's no one easy answer to that question.
Of course not. If there was, it would be a very short question, a very short answer.
One problem that we're encountering with social media is the ubiquity of harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the research that I have been doing recently has shown that feminist positions are very effectively harassed with new forms of social media.
Well, tell me about that. What kind of research are you doing?
Well, a couple of years ago, I published a piece on the College Anonymous Confession Board, and I interviewed students at various universities about their feminist perspectives and how that sort of connected to what I was seeing.
I have never heard.
College ACB.
No,
it was called Juicy Campus. It no longer exists because now people don't tend to sit at their computers and write things. They want iPhone apps and it's transmogrified into Yik Yak, which is an app that is widely used on college campuses.
I've heard a little bit about Yik Yak, but tell me about the College Anonymous Confession Board.
Well,
what the heck is that?
Well, that was a space on social media that was very widely used by, for example, UVA students, and you saw extremely what we'd call sexist commentary there, calling out women's by first and last names for their sexual behavior, talking about various parts of their body.
Okay,
the biggest
why was it called a confession board?
That I cannot really answer.
Well, did social media kind of start this
know.
Way? It started out as, I mean, Facebook started out as, this person's hot, this person's not, right? It's a, isn't that kind of how that all started? They
Facebook.
Put up the pictures of the incoming class and
yeah.
they talked about them.
Well, this is one problem. If you have the ubiquity of images, then you have the ubiquity of commentary on images. And we still tend to criticize women for how they look.
What do you mean by ubiquity? You mean omnipresence?
Ever-presentness.
Okay. All right.
Omnipresence. So, for example, I've been interviewing some high schoolers, and some high school girls told me that they were very into creative sewing.
Mm-hmm.
And one girl had made a new kind of bra.
Mm-hmm.
She was very proud of it. She posted a picture of herself on Yik Yak in this bra and immediately opened herself to this slew of critical commentary from her peers. High school students all over her community saying things like, you slut, how can you post such a picture? And it was really something, she just hadn't anticipated it because in her perspective, she was showing something she had created, something she'd sewn, and she didn't realize
it
that
didn't
just
occur
simple
to her that maybe posting that was going to draw some of this?
You might think it would have.
I would think
but,
that, you know, you would have that
my assessment
synapse.
Is that
I mean,
she was really pretty sincere.
You'd think that, wouldn't you?
And
wouldn't
thinking,
you be like, hmm.
Yeah, well, But I think that that might be an extreme story. Maybe. But that's a little bit of what women are facing now with various types of social media. We have very image-oriented media now with Snapchat and Instagram.
Man, Snapchat certainly. And Instagram are getting people in deep legal trouble. I am seeing it all over the place. Oh, God. You know, people take pictures and then, you know, they'll Snapchat it and somebody else will screenshot it and it'll save it, right?
Right.
You know, and it'll get circulated.
Right.
And, you know, stuff comes back. I mean, in any kind of criminal case, one of the first things you do is look up everybody's Facebook page to see what they posted about this at the time. Or, you know, what might be useful in cross-examining. Anybody
yeah,
in the face. People,
very
I mean, people will, you know, people who are dealing drugs will take pictures of their gun and their money and their bag of cocaine and put it up on their Facebook and say, I'm a gangsta. Right? You
as
know,
the,
and then
as,
that comes out as Commonwealth
as
Swan.
Said in one of the great films, they ain't in there for being smart.
That's true. But I mean, people do that, and it's created an enormous source of evidence for the police.
Interesting.
In a variety
of
cases.
Well, I think part of the problem is that young people now, and I'm talking about my college students, high school students. I have a son in high school, a daughter in college. So I hear about it at home. I hear about it in my classrooms, and I hear about it in my research. They are living in a world that almost enforces participation in these social media. Really, people don't think they have a choice about interacting on Snapchat or Instagram. And so there's a lot of trying to figure out what the norms of the communities are. I have a brilliant PhD student at UVA in sociology, Francesca Tripodi, who's doing her PhD dissertation on the use of Yik Yak. And one of the findings she's come across is that even though all the posts are anonymous, students want their posts to be popular.
Sure.
And we're a little stymied by that, because if the posts are anonymous, what is at stake, really,
well, I think
in popularity?
It's their own self-image, right? If I have said this thing and everybody likes it, then it's, you know, it's a feather in my cap,
if
nobody knows, right? And it's not that everybody else has
leader.
To see the feather. Right!
Yeah.
I'm the boss.
Exactly.
Right?
I'm man.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think people do know who posted these things. Lots of times there'll be content in the post, even though
maybe.
It doesn't say the
name.
Poster's name, there's enough content there that in the world of everybody snapping each other photos and messaging each other every 20 minutes about when they last blew their nose, you know who said that.
Well, and one of the interesting things, I just finished a wonderful J-term class. I had a wonderful group of UVA students called Race, Class, Sexuality, and Gender in the Teen Film. And
Wanda the Vampires.
They talked about a film that's been very popular called Project X. And then
one of
my research groups in the class did research on Snapchat, showing that people were posting party images crafted to look just like the parties shown in this film, Project X.
You mean people would pose folks at their apartment having a party to sort of mirror the shot?
The great party that Project X culminates in.
I see.
So we had a little debate about the influence
of hamburger, I guess. I mean, I don't understand the whole food thing. What is the Facebook, you know, here's a picture of what I ate last night.
I'm so cool. I have such a great life. See all the great food I'm eating
and
the traveling I'm doing.
I can understand. I'm in Paris.
The grandchildren I'm playing with. That's my own personal pet.
Here's my sandwich.
My wonderful sushi dinner.
Right? Yeah. Well, maybe. I mean, I can't taste a great pastry
I was eating in London, but that's the only time I've done that.
Maybe if it was something really exotic, right? You know, if you're, you know, having a plate of, I don't know, something that you can't get here. Something crazy, then like it would be interesting. But like if you've just gone to, you know, the local diner and taken a picture of your sandwich, I'm kind of
Yeah.
But, yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the real world and the effect that media has on RL. And in one of the things I want to talk to you about, I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and one of the things that the legal community has noticed over time is that juries are affected by crime dramas and cop shows and courtroom dramas. And
doesn't surprise me.
Particularly forensic stuff. You know, you see these shows where, like, dun-dun-dun, you know, somebody solves the crime of who murdered Joe Blow because they got the forensic fiber trace and the fingerprint off the this.
And it's so riveting.
And
they're so
everybody,
popular.
So juries now expect that kind of evidence. This is what I hear from my prosecutor friends.
How
and they, if you don't have something forensic, the jury is more unlikely to, is more likely to give you a not guilty verdict if you don't have some kind of forensics. Sometimes that makes sense. There are cases in which, yes, if this happened, there should be a forensic link. But sometimes it doesn't make sense. And, you know, people think this is how it is, right? Because TV says so. So I've been seeing that. And another thing that I want to talk about a little bit is this whole Rolling Stone thing with UVA, right?
Oh, do you?
I do, because I live dangerously.
Are you involved in that?
No, I'm not. Although I do defend rape cases sometimes, right? And I had a rape charge that was going to trial.
You mean
I defend the guy
accused of
raping, right? I had a case like that.
Okay.
At the time the Rolling Stone article came out,
oh,
I had a jury trial going to trial.
Were these college-aged students?
They were young people in this case. They weren't UVA students. They were, you know, early mid-20s. And so this article hits the media, right? And everybody, you know, suddenly I'm very worried about my jury, right? Because suddenly this is the narrative going through everybody's mind, right? They're all going to think this person's guilty because, you know, this is the story.
Yeah.
Well, then about 3 days before the trial, bam, the reversal hits.
Wow.
Right? And so now the prosecutor's looking at me across the courtroom, and I know what they're thinking. They're thinking, oh, man, they're all going to be thinking she's lying because, right? And in the end, you know, that has nothing to do with this case, but I think it has a real effect on people.
Oh, it does. It definitely does. Just to begin with the Rolling Stone issue. Well, actually, let's begin with the media violence issue, because early research on media and violence done by George Gerbner at the Annenberg School back in the 60s and 70s, there were a series of studies done called the Cultivation Studies, and what he found, that was back in the era of primetime television, so it was a little easier to measure what people were watching when they watched
television.
Are we talking
about like Dallas and Falcon's Crest?
No, we're talking about 10 years earlier than
Dallas.
10 years
earlier than that, okay.
The 60s.
Help me out.
Oh, Dragnet.
Okay.
The Defenders.
All right.
Early crime TV.
All right.
What we found is that, and he had hundreds of hours of footage that researchers analyzed and hundreds of interviews with TV watchers. He found that the universe on primetime television at that time was more violent than real life. You had much more risk when you left your house of being shot if you were in that universe.
Right.
Much more risk of being the victim of violent crime, et cetera. Many more violent crimes than in actual life.
Right.
And that heavy TV viewers believed that the world was more violent than it really was.
They believed that the world was more dangerous.
Exactly. It cultivated a vision of the world that was more resembled the television universe more than the real universe.
Well, I think this happens to everybody in some sense. I mean, as an attorney, I remember as a student going into law school and becoming like this mm-hmm. person who all I did all day was read cases, right? And if something terrible doesn't happen, there is no case, right? If Susie and Bobby go on a picnic and they have a nice time, there's
doesn't
no case.
Enter the law books.
Right? That's right. You know, you only read about it if something unexpected and heinous happens.
So as a result, you know, I would say that we can't easily do cultivation studies now because the television universe is way more varied and the American public is watching different pockets of people are watching different types of shows.
People
However, they have way more options. However, forensic crime shows mm-hmm. are very popular. So it doesn't surprise me at all that you're saying on average, juries' vision of what a criminal trial is like probably resembles that universe of forensic crime shows more than it does what real trials are like.
I have
that doesn't surprise me at all.
Real-world prosecutors in real-world cases get up and ask questions of juries on voir dire when they're selecting people for the jury, which are basically designed to educate on that point. You know, how many of you have seen this kind of show?
Right.
You know,
and then
do you understand that? you know, there isn't always forensic evidence in a, you know.
So interesting. So that doesn't surprise me. And I think there is a probably a measurable impact of the vast popularity of forensic crime shows. And they are very entertaining. You know, personally, I'm a great fan of true crime novels.
Well, media has...
Which terrify me, of
course. Has huge, huge impacts on real life. Real life... impacts media, I guess, in that it gives us ideas about stories, and then we tell these stories, and you only tell the dramatic stories, right? Because if you don't tell the undramatic stories, there is no story.
Moving to the Rolling Stone event, as a feminist sociologist who, you know, I've been doing this for several decades, we understand that rape is a huge social problem. We understand that sexual violence should be discussed more in the media. We understand that rape trials are often very difficult for defendants and victims because the evidence is difficult.
Those cases are heinous for everybody.
So this has been going on for decades of, it's been recognized in feminist research and in the feminist community. However, the general public seems to have certain biases. People don't necessarily understand, here's my favorite word again, the ubiquity of rape. People don't understand the problems victims might have in presenting convincing evidence and how difficult it is to get convictions, and probably many guilty rapists often go free. So
I can't. I just can't, as a criminal defense attorney, let you like make that statement.
Am I totally wrong?
Well, it's not that you're totally wrong. I think probably many guilty rapists go free, and I also think probably many innocent people are convicted. I think both of those things are true because
that
our system
me.
Is just not that great.
It's a tough system
sorting this out.
I think,
especially
that,
when you get into an issue of consent, when you get into a she consented, she didn't consent, and then you're talking about later on. And what perceptions are, and it's such a
Well, I think, you know, so one of the outcomes, so you have this Rolling Stone journalist, Erdely, going out and saying, I really want a newsworthy case to bring this issue to the consciousness of the American public.
Sure.
And she seems to have made some erroneous decisions.
Well, she just picked the wrong story. That's
all. She picked the wrong story. She also investigated it in a very biased way, which I still don't fully understand how a journalist could have done that, except that maybe she had a point to prove and she wanted a particular type of story and she wasn't paying enough attention
to
the details
of the story. This is something we call confirmation bias in the law, right? You have a police officer who thinks that this person is guilty. They will see their interactions with that person in terms of confirming that suspicion that they have. Right? You know, if you have a theory as a scientist, you will interpret your data.
Exactly.
If you're not a particularly good scientist, sometimes exactly. in a way that confirms whatever your theory is.
You know, and I think that normally in the media, we don't have this particular bias that Early presented in the Rolling Stone article.
I think
normally,
we just don't have it to that extent, maybe.
Well, I think we really believe women often bring false charges. And as a feminist sociologist, I think that's not the biggest problem in this area.
As a criminal defense attorney, I think women do bring false charges, but I also think people deny things that they've done. I think both of those things are true, and I think you can't generalize. You have to look at a specific case and say, this is the evidence we've got in this case. And when you sort of take that cultural perspective and go, women don't lie about rape, I it's not fair to apply that cultural perspective to a single case.
Well, as a sociologist, I'd probably disagree with you there, and I'd say
women what makes radio shows
do
interesting.
Sometimes lie about rape, but pretty rarely.
Yeah,
because proving these rape cases.
On that? I mean, where do you?
Well, it's difficult.
You get
it
them based
difficult.
On whether or not somebody was convicted, right? I mean, that's how you decide whether it was true or not.
Feminist sociologists, no. Based on interviews with women bringing charges and a scientist's assessment of whether people are telling us the truth, which could be wrong. It could certainly be wrong. It's a different standard of evidence, I think, than what you're talking about in the courtroom.
Yeah.
Different groups of people. But let me just go on. So Erdely has this article. It accomplishes for a month what she wants it to accomplish. The national conversation. President Obama. Everyone is focused on this issue of sexual violence on campuses. I'm getting called right and left. I'm going on TV, on radio. People who have ignored me for three decades are calling me up. You know, it really was a sea change in the cultural attention paid to sexual violence. And I think she knew as a journalist that she needed an extremely sensational case to affect that.
That's right.
And I don't
think... The problem
think
was that she picked a sensational case that was a little too sensational.
It was
it
too sensational and badly documented, unfortunately.
So the problem is knowing which case it is at the outset.
We're really... we're sure that she made some mistakes now. This case probably didn't happen, certainly not in the way she reported it. However... I think she still has accomplished the sea change of focusing. You know, here we are on the radio talking about rape. We wouldn't be talking about college rape if this article hadn't been published.
I think that's true, and I think it's kind of fascinating that, you know, we have this whole national media story about this horrific gang rape. And then it turns out not to be true, and there's a huge retraction from Rolling Stone, and there's this whole... And still... The momentum is the original story.
This is, unfortunately, the dynamic of media influence in our society right now.
I don't know that it's a bad outcome, necessarily. I mean, the fact that this individual person lied about this...
It's bad that she needed to use a false case.
It wasn't verifiable or...
To accomplish the sea change.
Sure.
Could she have used a true case? Maybe, if she had searched a little harder... And paid a little more attention to verifying the facts of the case she wrote up. If she had a little more time, if society was a little less rushed, if there wasn't a deadline looming over her head, which I'm sure there was.
You can get seduced by a good story. I mean, I think especially as a writer, right?
Yeah, sure. And she clearly did. I mean, that was, you know, that was a good story. Although I have to tell you that my journalist friends, the day it came out, no one believed it.
Really?
It was very evident to practice journalists that this was not true.
Oh,
and I think it was just too detailed, too specific, too perfect for the point she wanted to make. And real life is often not that perfect. In any case, just to get back, yes, has this had an impact on the juries you're going to be facing over the next 10 years? I'd say probably.
Oh, yeah, I think it definitely has.
And maybe it's sensitized them. I mean, I know I'm involved in an ongoing research project now to investigate exactly those issues you were bringing up. What does consent mean to students on campuses across the country? who consents, how do students consent, who defines an incident as coercion, who mm-hmm. defines. We have found in this study that sometimes you can interview both students involved in a sexual incident, and one interprets it as pleasurable and the result of two consenting adults, and the other interprets it as rape.
Oh, doesn't that happen in almost every rape case? I mean, other
well,
than
you
me,
would
it
know.
Wasn't me once.
You would know.
But, you know, for, I mean, that's the hardest cases to prosecute, and the easiest ones to defend are the ones that turn uh-huh. on that issue. If the guy says,
it wasn't me.
Right.
I didn't
right.
do it. Then you go and you get some DNA and you're dead in the water, right?
Yeah. Right. If the guy says, yeah, we, you know, went home and, you know, we had sex
it
and it was fun and, right, you
she
know.
She liked it.
Yeah, then, you know, then you've got something to argue about in court.
Yeah. Well, so we're investigating how does it start in very young people's sexual experiences, and what can we do to make campuses safer for young people?
Just in the last few minutes, because I can't possibly leave this conversation without another majorly controversial topic.
Oh, excellent.
I think I saw that you were doing a project, research, a book, something on abortion in media.
I did publish a book on
you
abortion
did?
In media.
Talk to me a little bit about that and about how that fits into our conversation. I'm thinking about, you know, media affects how people think about things.
Yes.
And I'm looking at the abortion debates right now, and I'm looking at, you know, some of the fundy churches putting up pictures of aborted fetuses, right, and going, oh, this is terrible, right? And then I'm looking at the, you know, the sort of bumper sticker communication back and forth, you know, these cute little slogans, three-word slogans slapped on somebody's bumper that are supposed to convey this whole debate, the idea that we can reduce it all to a platitude. And then I'm looking at one of my favorite media moments in the past couple of years was Rachel Maddow's show where she comes out with the commemorative Bob McDonnell vaginal ultrasound probe. Do you remember this legislation
yes.
in Virginia? Bob McDonnell is going to, like, you know, make everybody essentially get raped in order to get an abortion. And, you know, she puts out this you know, picture of what looks like a huge medical
it
dildo, right?
Like
with, you know,
it.
Bob McDonald's name on it, right? You know, and pow, that tanked like, you know, nobody's
business.
Well,
you know, abortion is one of those issues that I think the American public suffers from not paying more attention to data and sociological fact. I think we'd all be more intelligent debaters on this issue if we looked at who gets abortions and why. And we know a fair amount about that.
Well, who gets abortions and why?
Women from almost every walk of life, including fundamentalist Christian women,
mm-hmm.
get abortions. Poor people get abortions. Wealthy people get abortions. Mm-hmm. Married women get abortions. Unmarried women get abortions. It is a widely used mm-hmm. Right.
Why?
By women making reproductive choices for a variety of reasons. You know, as the mother of two children, I can tell you that being pregnant and delivering a child is no trivial occupation. It is an enormous physical project. It has a measurable impact on your body, your life, your health, your emotional life. And I think women know this, and they don't always choose to give birth.
And how do you think it helps the consciousness on this issue to know these facts? How do you think that this data
helps? Well, I think that what I found when I did research, this book came out in 1999. It's called Speaking of Abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at primetime television depictions of abortion, and for the most part, we were showing only poor women mm-hmm. or unmarried, very young women seeking abortion, and that projected kind of a false image
mm-hmm.
of who was seeking mm-hmm. abortions mm-hmm. and why they were seeking them.
Right.
And I think people don't understand how widespread the practice of abortion is mm-hmm. and the need for abortion. What they also don't know is very much about the history of abortion, what impact on society there was of abortion being illegal. So mm-hmm. if we look back before the Roe v. Wade decision, 1972, we see many, many women dying in the attempt to self-induce abortion mm-hmm. with coat hangers, with knives, falling mm-hmm. down steps, violent imagery, going to unlicensed clinics mm-hmm. that were illegal, that often were unsanitary, people getting infections, not being able to be treated because they'd undergone an illegal procedure. And, of course, wealthy people traveling to places where abortion was legal still being able to seek abortions, but poorer women facing
risks. So is your, sort of, kind of that, you know, having an unrealistic media depiction of the issue
It influences the debate.
Real-life debate.
I think it does. I think people are being very unrealistic, and they're sometimes supporting positions that could cause widespread harm to women who still form the majority of our population.
Well, Dr. Press, thank you so much. I want to thank you for being here. I really enjoyed having you on the show.
This was wonderful to meet you.
Kind of a fascinating panoply of difficult topics, convoluted topics.
Thanks for bringing them all up.
Thank you so much. This is 94.7 WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you have been listening to Straight Talk. We'll be back next week. Have a good weekend.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.